was a named insured.
I read that, I understand where you're going then. As I read that statute, it says, it doesn't talk about insurers. It talks about first-party claimants. And it says a first-party claimant is an individual asserting an entitlement to benefits owed directly to or on behalf of an insured under the insurance policy. So you're saying that she doesn't qualify under the definition of a first-party claimant. Is that the essence of your argument?
That is.
Okay.
And I can clarify.
Okay.
Because the question of reformation was present in the case and may be somewhat confusing, because once during the course of litigation, American Family received evidence that Ms. Hansen was in fact the owner of the auto for which the policy was written, it became clear that she should have been the named insured. It was her auto. But, and it was at that point that American Family made the effort to reform the policy and in fact paid the benefits to Ms. Hansen. And the most curious development in the case was that for whatever tactical reasons, Ms. Hansen chose to challenge that reformation successfully and persuaded the trial court to rule as, on an in limine motion that we were not allowed to tell the jury that there had been a reformation.
And was the jury advised that you had paid the $75,000?
Yes. The jury was aware of that. But the policy...
Doesn't the reformation constitute an admission by you that she's an insured then?
No. No, Your Honor.
Or the payment of the
payment.
And where did you raise this in front of the trial court that she's not insured? Did you move J&OV for on that issue?
We brought it up in our pre-trial motion practice. We brought it up during the course of trial. We brought it up as a directed verdict, and we brought it up with regard to our discussion of the jury instructions.
The difference between a declaration paid and a lien holder's use only page.
A declaration page is issued by the insurance company, specifically by the underwriting department. It is issued when a policy is first enacted or incepted, and anytime there is a change in coverage after that, a new declaration page is issued. A declaration page can only be issued by the insurance company, and there is a record of that history of the declaration pages in the underwriting department's electronic file. A lien holder, for lien holder use page, is something that is apparently a resource that is available to insurance agents. My understanding it is to provide information, say, when someone insures their car and there is a lender that needs to have information that there's insurance on that car, then the agency can issue that lien holder page.
So the agent can't issue a declaration page.
Right, and that was clear in the evidence, and the agent in this case agreed that he had no authority to issue a declaration page. I don't think there's any dispute by any of the witnesses in trial in that regard. And I'll also say, and I realize that the reason for that question is that there was a lien holder use page that had been issued to Jenny Davis.
Three of them.
Well,
we gotta run the record.
Would
the statements, whether it be a declaration page or not, but the statements of the insurance agent be binding on the insurance company?
I believe not. And there was some discussion of that during the trial. An agent has binding authority. That is true, that when someone comes in and they apply for insurance, the agent has binding authority to say, yes, we will grant you insurance, so that person is now protected. But then the insurance company issues a policy, and it is the policy that controls.
Well, you've got a policy that's out there, but you have an agency, perhaps, or an agent representing something else. And why wouldn't the agent's representations be binding upon the agency? Is there a law that says this particular type of representation is not binding on the insurance company?
Well, my understanding is of the case law is that the insurance agent only has the binding authority, and that only lasts up until the policy is written. I think Pete Satire is a case that speaks to that. But under the facts of this case, there can only be one declaration page. that's in effect for a policy, because anytime you have a history of some years and changes of coverage in that policy, there's going to be new declaration pages issued. So by definition, there's going to be some difference between an earlier declaration page and the current declaration page. That doesn't create an ambiguity. It doesn't create an inconsistency, because the declaration pages state, each and every one of them, that this declaration page supersedes any of the ones that have gone before.
That same statement very similar is also on the lien holder statement.
Correct.
At the bottom, with facsimile signatures of officers of the company. Right. The only difference between the two pages is a little language at the top.
Correct. But the point is in order to determine whether the policy is ambiguous, we have to define what the policy is. And the policy can only be the policy form and the declaration page in effect at the time of the accident.
Let me ask you this question.
Yes, sir.
She, Ms. Hansen, said that she went into the agent and bought a policy. Okay, that was in her name alone on that car, and that she made monthly payments for several years. Is there evidence to support that? I mean, she said she made them automatically out of her bank account. Were her bank statements admitted into evidence and that showed she had in fact been paying premiums?
No, but we don't dispute that she may have been the one who paid the premiums.
Oh, you're saying she paid the premiums not on this policy she said she went and purchased, but she paid the premiums on the parent's policy?
Yes. And the agent described in his testimony that the person who was billed isn't necessarily the person who's the named insured on the policy. That is not an unusual circumstance. But again, going back to the Reformation, we accept that she understood she was the policy insured. There may very well have been a miscommunication or misunderstanding between her and American Family. We're not challenging that. That is where the idea of Reformation comes in. And it was their choice before the trial court to oppose the Reformation, and they insisted that the policy to be interpreted was the policy as written, not a policy as reformed.
That question was submitted to the jury, correct?
Correct.
On verdict form B, they found she was the insured. Correct.
Right. And
did you object to that instruction being submitted to the jury?
Yes.
And then after the jury returned its verdict, did you move for JNOV on this, on the legal basis that she's not the insured?
I did not move for JNOV, but I did make my record when we made the record on the jury instructions.
So do you have any authority that indicates that when you have these conflicting documents, one a technical declaration page, one a looks like a declaration, a pseudo declaration page, the lien holders page, that as a matter of law, the inconsistency cannot be considered because as a matter of law, only the declaration page counts?
No, I do not have any case law to say that, because I'm not aware of any caliber case law that addresses this situation.
Does the policy say that?
Yes, I believe the language on the declaration page, which describes...
But the language on the declaration page is the same language on the lien holder page.
But the language that I'm referring to,
okay,
says declarations effective on the date shown above. These declarations form a part of the policy and replace all other declarations which may have been issued previously.
It's identical language on both documents.
Correct, which means that we need to look at the one that was current and in effect, because that one superseded any prior declaration page.
No, but I mean, it's also on the lien holder's page.
Correct. I understand.
The same language appears. So
the lien holder page was issued back in 07. There were subsequent declaration pages issued after that. And the declaration pages, all the declaration pages issued by American Family, all consistently identified William and Joyce Davis as the named insurance.
Does the lien holder statement purport to cover the period of time in which the accident occurred?
It says from December 15, 2006 until canceled. And then you need to look at the language down at the bottom that says anytime that there's another declaration page, once there's a change in coverage, you need to look at that declaration page.
Correct if I'm wrong. doesn't one of the lien holder's statements also cover this policy and name Ms. Hansen as the insured?
No, I don't believe so. There was never any declaration page.
I didn't say declaration
page. There was never any lien holder page issued before this accident identifying Jennifer Hansen as a named insured. There was one that she requested from the agency that she received, but that was 2 years later. There was never any lien holder page issued before this accident identifying Jennifer Hansen as named insured.
Now, the expert, plaintiff's expert, testified that the adjuster should have immediately asked if she owns the car.
Correct.
And that didn't happen.
We don't know whether the adjuster did. The adjuster did ask that question. The adjuster was not successful in ever reaching Jennifer Hansen to have.
I know that she never got an answer.
Right.
Okay.
That's correct.
To any of her questions, even under threat of closing the claim. But was she asked in that early stage of the claims process if she owned the car?
I believe so.
Okay.
That's from memory, and
you're hesitating.
I am hesitating on that, Your Honor. Yeah. I don't want to misspeak.
I think that was what the expert criticized American Family for.
It was.
Was that she was not asked who owned the car.
Correct. And my issue on appeal is that on cross-examination, when I took that same expert through who is the insured, he agreed every step of the way that the insured was not Jennifer Hansen, but was William and Joyce Davis, which to my mind means that all of his criticisms on the claims handling go out the window.
So you're suggesting that the question of who is the name insured is a construction question and a question of law which we reviewed de novo?
I absolutely am submitting that.
It's not a question of fact as between two inconsistent sets of statements.
I don't believe so, because it goes back to the question of what is the policy in the first place.
Counsel, if I could ask you another issue that has been raised, interpretation. What's wrong with the trial court's interpretation of the remedies statute?
In terms of the
statutory bad faith. Yep. And I'll bet Judge Roy will give you a little bit more time.
Okay.
I hope.
I really don't have much more to add to what we put in the briefs, because I think Judge Hoffman's decision in the StressCon case, the trial court decision, I think articulated it pretty well.
Is that on appeal?
It is on appeal.
Has not been resolved yet.
That one, I understand, has not been resolved yet. But essentially, the idea is that the statute doesn't say there's a penalty of twice the covered benefit. It says that the damages are twice the covered benefit plus attorney's fees.
What's the covered benefit?
$75,000. So twice.
Two times that. $75,000 is one. That's what the judge said, right?
Well, but then the judge didn't take into account the fact that the $75,000 had already been paid.
What language in the statute suggests that should be taken into account?
Because the statute doesn't talk about a penalty. So I would reasonably read the statutory language to mean that the covered benefit is part of the twice the covered benefit that's to be awarded. And here's the problem, because otherwise American Family is penalized for having paid the money ahead of time. Let's say they hadn't paid the $75,000 and they go to trial. The most that could be awarded on the statutory damages is $150,000.
Here, $75,000, because you could have been recovered if she had gone over the contract.
Correct.
Still would have been the same result. Whether they paid it or not, doesn't make a difference.
Actually, not the way I look at it. If American Family hadn't paid the $75,000, then the verdict on the statutory bad faith would have still been $150,000.
Right. The fact that you paid the $75,000, correct me if I'm wrong, relieved the plaintiff of proving her damages from the accident. I mean, she doesn't get benefits under UIM unless her injuries exceed
right. What
she received from the tortfeasor. So she has to prove a gap. She has to prove a gap. Now she doesn't have to prove that because you've already paid the policy limits. Benefit does not equal policy limit. Benefit equals what she should have been paid under the policy.
I agree.
And you conceded it was $75,000 by paying.
Right.
Well, is that right or wrong?
No, I agree with you.
Okay. Good. How much time should I give him, Judge Daly?
Judge Roy, I would leave it to your discretion.
Can I make just one more point?
Sure.
And then I'll
I feel like Mr. McNeil a little bit.
Last point is that I don't think any of this makes a difference, given that the trial or the jury awarded zero damages. And it was within the province of the jury to decide the amount of damages. It was plaintiff's burden of proving damages. This was not an all or nothing damages case. The jury could have awarded anything between zero and $75,000 in damages. They awarded zero. I think that verdict should be honored, respected, and upheld.
Thank you, counsel. We'll add 3 minutes to him, and if Appley gets dragged over the finish line with questions, we'll do the same.
Discretion.
You got 18 anyway, so go.
May it please the court. Nelson Boyle, 39525, for the plaintiff, Jennifer Hansen. With me at council table is Sam Livingston, who served as trial counsel, and the other trial counsel, John Truax, is in the courtroom as well. American Family is asking the court to interpret these lien holders two different ways. Now, they're saying that it's not evidence of coverage here, but they also send these out to lien holders as evidence of coverage. They do.
That's not the question, is it?
I'm sorry?
It's not the question whether this policy ever had that coverage. The question is what was the coverage and what was the status of the policy on the day of the accident?
Yes. Isn't it? That's the question. But the policy that American Family provided, the certified copy of the policy, was ambiguous because when you consider the other facts, like these other deck sheets, or lien holder sheets, when you consider the facts that the court found in on the third day of trial during the hearing on ambiguity, there was an ambiguity here because there's numerous ways to there's a deck sheet that says Jenny Davis was covered from April 2007.
Is that a deck sheet or is that a lien holder page?
It's a lien holder page, but it says at the bottom these declarations are binding on the company.
Do you have any authority that says a lien holder page is of equal status as a declaration page?
I don't, but American Family daily sends those out to lien holders. You know, you go to Toyota or somewhere and you buy a car and it's a Saturday and you call up your insurer, they call your insurer and they say, send us a lien holder page to evidence coverage. So if they're out there in the market evidencing coverage with these things, which is what they just what they just argued, that these are used to send to lien holders, well, how can they argue out of the same breath that they're not evidence of coverage here?
Do you disagree with counsel's statement that there was no lien holder page issued before the accident naming Ms. Hansen or Davis as the insured?
I do disagree that there was nothing that said Jenny, because there was a Jenny Davis sheet that was issued before.
There was one
that was issued before the crash that said Jenny Hansen. But after the crash, there were several that were issued that said Jenny Hansen was covered on that date.
Before the crash was the one that said Jenny Davis was covered?
There was, from April 2007. I can't remember where in the record that came in, but I know that the court referenced it in its findings of fact before making conclusions of law in the hearing
This is not a matter of a contract being ambiguous. Is it not a matter that two people brought in two documents and said, this is the contract?
Well, yes. I mean, there's two different documents that different people...
They're saying, he's presenting that. That's not the contract. This is the contract.
Yeah.
Okay. And it seems to me that's a question of fact for the jury.
I agree. Okay. I agree. And the jury made that finding of fact in verdict form B. And I believe was properly instructed on that.
Let's go to the damages. We went there last on appellant's argument, but the statute says that if payment of a benefit is unreasonably delayed or unreasonably denied, then the claimant may recover two times the benefit. Is that basically what it says? I mean, that's not a direct quote.
Yeah, it's basically what it says.
Okay, but it talks about recovering in the lawsuit two times the benefit. That is in the nature of a penalty, but all it is an escalation of damages. Mm. And here, she's recovered. During the litigation, they offered and paid $75,000, which was the policy limit.
Yes, sir.
They don't get any credit for that, right? They're still going to recover under the action two times that.
Yes, sir.
Under the court's order.
Yes,
now, what would happen if they hadn't paid? And they said, well, I won't pay this because at the end you're going to ask for two times this. If I don't pay it, all you get is two times it.
Your Honor, in the statute that you're referring to is 10.3.11.16 subsection 1, and that's the damage or the penalty section. And then subsection 4 of the same statute, 10.3.11.16, says that the damages allowed under this statute do not limit recovery under any other claim for relief. And so if they had not paid the $75,000, the claim for relief for that would be breach of contract, not paying the $75,000 that you owe us, or you owe me. And so then you would be able to have that $75,000 under the breach of contract claim, and separately under the breach of the statutory claim for unreasonable delay or denial, $150,000.
So it's your view that the claims stack?
Yes. Under section or paren four, the subsection 4 of the statute. And there's two cases that are somewhat on point. They look at a different statute. It's section 13.21.102, subsection 3. And they, which I believe is the punitive damages statute, but they, that's Tate v. Hartford, 49 Pacific 3rd, 337, which is a Colorado Court of Appeals case, and Coors v. Security Life, 112 Pacific 3rd, 59, page 66.
Cite those cases in your briefs, counsel?
I don't believe I did cite those in the brief.
Did you cite them as supplemental authorities to this court?
I have not.
And did you notify opposing counsel that you were going to discuss these cases today?
I did not.
I think we may have a problem.
Also, Mahoney, which was decided last week, and I've been told that they're considering putting or asking the court to publish that opinion, but it's unpublished, decided this issue, and I'm not going to go into that because it's an unpublished opinion, but if before this court rules that were to be decided whether that's going to be published, then I'd ask the court to consider if it is published.
That's a Court of Appeals case, Mahoney?
That was a Court of Appeals case. It was Mahoney v. American Family.
Another case that wasn't in your briefs?
Yes, but it's I couldn't cite it as additional authority because it's not authority. I'm just bringing to the court's attention because if the court were to issue a ruling here that was contrary to that and both were to be published, then, you know, the court might be concerned with that.
We've done it many.
I'm aware.
Counsel, the statute says that you recover two times the covered benefit. It doesn't say two times the payment the insurance company makes. It doesn't say two times the policy limit.
You're arguing that two times the cover benefit, in effect, means two times the policy limit, correct? And that's what the court seemed to have found here.
Well, the statute says two times the benefit owed.
Times the cover.
Two times the payment owed.
Times the covered benefit. I'm looking at the statute.
So two times the covered benefit is, they by paying the $75,000 admitted that the covered benefit is $75,000.
So had they ended up settling this case with your client not for $75,000, but let's just say $1,000, your position would be that the covered benefit would be $1,000 times two, and that would be all that you would get under an 1116 remedy.
If no other evidence came in that they believed that wasn't a fair amount, but if the plaintiff had settled for that, then that would be a concession by the plaintiff that the benefit owed was $1,000. I don't know how the plaintiff would overcome that with evidence. It seems like it would have been an admission, just like paying $75,000 would be an admission that it is that the measure of the benefit owed is $75,000 because that's what American Family paid.
Be that the covered benefit is not the policy limit. It has to do with how much was paid.
Yes, Your Honor.
Even though the statute also uses the phrase payment of benefits as opposed to covered benefit, which seems to be a different terminology to me.
Well, I think that the question on delay or denial is on payment, and so whether there's a delay of payment or a denial of payment. And so here, for instance, you know, the American Family offered the money on one date and paid on another date, and I don't have those two dates in front of me, but that could be construed as a denial if they didn't proffer a check when they offered it. And an insurer, the measure in the statute under 1115 paren 1 is a delay or denial of payment of the benefits. So you can't just say, you know, we agree we owe you this and then hold on to the money as an insurer. They have to proffer the money when they agree that they owe it.
Basically, you're saying it's two times the amount that was paid or settled for. That's how you understand covered benefit. That's what you understand it to mean.
In this case, yes, under these facts. I guess what I'm saying is I wouldn't, in another case with different facts, I'd have to consider those facts. But here they've admitted that $75,000 because that's what they paid.
What do we do with the jury's verdict of zero?
Well, the verdict form was erroneous. Under the Kisselman case.
Did you object to it?
They did object. Plaintiff proffered a separate verdict form. It was erroneous because it asked for causation. There's no causation element in the statute. It also didn't need to ask for these damages because here the damages were already known. The amount was already known. And so the only question that needed to be asked was there an unreasonable delay or denial of the payment of benefits owed? And that's, in Kisselman, the ruling said there's only one question in this statute. Arguably, there's maybe another question if, for instance, they didn't pay the $75,000 or offer it before trial, and, you know, the breach of contract claim was a separate question, because then the jury would have to say, you know, on that claim, is there a breach of contract? And if so, how much did American Family owe? And once they figured out how much American Family owed there, then that amount would be doubled for the statutory claim and added on to that. If there's no further questions, I'll just revert the rest of my time to the court. Thank you very much. Counsel reminded me that the jury's answer of $0, there were no
damages still owed under the contract at that point because they had paid it.
This was not under the contract claim. This was under the statutory claim.
But the court's finding below, which is consistent with the plaintiff's argument below, is that the question ended up being erroneous to ask that because it confused the jury. And so the court basically
disregarded it.
Yes. And that is supported in the Burgess case, I think. And that's been briefed.
Counsel, I tend to agree with you.
I'm sorry.
I tend to agree with you that asking the jury to assess damages is not correct under the statute. And I know Kisselman says, and I think I was on that division, that only one question needs to be asked. But as I look at the statute now, it seems like it might also be appropriate for the jury to decide, was there an unreasonable delay or denial, yes or no? If so, what was the covered benefit?
Yes.
And I'm wondering if that's what the judge was trying to, or the verdict form was trying to get at when he used the word damages as opposed to covered benefit.
It may have been. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, American Family here had admitted it was $75,000. So, and that's why I said in a case where there was still the breach of contract claim out there, the jury would have to determine that amount because they'd have to, you know, find first that there was a breach of the contract and then how much the amount of the contract was if they found there was a breach.
They have to do it under the statutory claim also.
They do, but once the defendant has admitted that that amount is owed by paying it.
And that's the maximum amount they're exposed
to. That's the maximum amount they're exposed to. But, you know, even if the defendant had paid, you know, $75,000 and they owed $100,000 and plaintiff had accepted that and not objected to that or presented evidence that they should have been paid more or some other facts, you know, if that was it, then it would be $75,000 times two for the statutory penalty. You're not automatically entitled, the plaintiff's not automatically entitled to two times the policy limits. It's two times the benefit owed. And so if both parties agreed it was $75,000, even though the policy limit was much more, then two times that amount would be $150,000. Counsel also asked me to point out that there were two deck sheets that were in effect at the time of the crash.
That showed what?
One showing Jennifer Hansen and one showing her parents, the Davis.
On the same policy?
Yes. And
two,
also
the two deck sheets or a deck sheet and a lien holder page?
Yes. And I wouldn't know.
Were there any declaration pages saying that?
Wait.
Were there any declaration pages? I realize you merged them, okay? I'm separating them. Were there any declaration pages listing her as the insured?
I can't point to the spot in the record, but counsel informs me that there was one, and I am not able to point to that spot in the record, but
I read declaration pages until they're coming, and I haven't found one.
Okay. I'd also point out that, you know, in the trial testimony, the facts showed that, you know, Jenny Hansen testified, and there was nothing to contradict this, that she owned the car from day one in 2000. It was in May 2000. In June 2000, she walked into Heath Burchell's agency and purchased an insurance policy. Her parents came in later and added their cars, and somehow something happened. But even if she was...
added their cars to her policy?
Well, they ended up, American Family ended up making those all together, you know, a family car policy, but they do that because if they issue two separate UM/UIM, you know, then they can have double coverage and those kinds of issues. So, but she paid her own premiums the whole way. She testified to that. There was nothing to contradict that. And American Family lost the application page that she filled out for her car. They don't have one for that. In the evidence, there's...
would that be in the agency or would that be in the insurance company?
Well, the agency should have still had that, but they also type in all that information into the mainframe, and the insurance company receives that, and they didn't have that information either for that car.
Counsel, I have a suggestion. If there is a declaration page that was in effect at the time of the accident, a declaration page issued by the insurance company that was in the record, maybe you'll just give us a letter citing to the place in the record where it appears. Or the page in your brief where it was cited? I understand you were at the trial counsel.
Would you like me to file that with...
I think with the clerk of the court, I think would be helpful.
Just send a letter addressed to us individually.
Okay.
That way it'll come to us rather than go through the labyrinth.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Two points. First, on the issue of what was the policy. You asked the question of plaintiff counsel whether there's a fact issue of which of two different contracts were in place, and I would agree that if that was the dynamic presented to the jury, that would be a fact issue. That would be a jury question. I don't believe that's the situation we're dealing with. There was only one premium paid. There was only one policy issued. For 5 years, American Family was issuing deck pages to who they understood to be...
Isn't the question, though, who had the policy?
Yes.
One policy, who had the policy?
Yes.
That's not a fact question?
Not under this policy, because if... Again, it gets back to the threshold question is, what is the policy? And if we agree that the policy is the deck page in effect plus the policy form, there's nothing ambiguous within that contract. It's clearly stated who the insured is. And I think that, as I read the case law, we can't look at extrinsic evidence to vary the terms of the written contract itself. And that is, I think, what plaintiffs are trying to do. They had a remedy. They could have agreed with the reformation of the policy.
Let me ask you this. You say that they put all these cars in one policy.
No, actually, there were separate policies issued for each car.
For each car?
Yes.
Okay.
There were. And then last point I want to make has to do with the damages. The statutory, or the bad faith statute, doesn't automatically award twice the damages for the covered benefit. It's only that portion of that that is unreasonably delayed in payment. And recall that in verdict form C, the jury had held that their American Family's denial of the claim based on the coverage issues was reasonable. So we have to reconcile the verdict form on the common law bad faith and the verdict form on the statutory bad faith.
Oh, they're two different standards.
Well, no, because the...
Doesn't Kisselman say that?
But when you look at the verdict form and the way it was separated out, the questions as to whether there was a reckless disregard is a different question than whether there was an unreasonable denial. And the jury specifically answered that there was not an unreasonable denial of this claim. That is
for bad faith purposes.
Yes. That is the very same question that then they're asked about the statutory bad faith. Same standard. So the jury is the one who decides not what was the covered benefit, but what was the portion of the covered benefit that was unreasonably delayed in payment. And their answer was zero. This was not an all-or-nothing case. Part of plaintiff's theory was that American Family made an unreasonably low settlement offer after they had agreed to pay benefits. That they put that into evidence in the trial. That was one of the things they were asking the jury to consider. And under that theory, it's not all-or-nothing. The jury can award $1, $30,000, or they can award zero. They awarded zero. Stock and jury instructions say that under the statutory bad faith claim, it is the plaintiff's burden of proving the amount of damages that are to be awarded.
Say damage, it's two times the cover, say up to two times the covered benefit. It says two times the covered benefit.
That is unreasonably delayed in payment. And so, in some cases, it'll be one and the same. I certainly agree with that. But under a plaintiff's own theory in this case, it's not necessarily one and the same. They're two different
things. You're facing your second red light. My back is stiffening.
Are you going to give him a chance to write a letter addressing the three authorities?
Yeah. Would you like to write a companion letter with respect to whether there are any declaration pages showing policy in effect at the time? The accident?
Yes, and can I file that within 5 days of receipt of this?
That's fine.
What I'm responding to?
Well, let's do it 3 days and 3 days. You have 3 days to get a letter in the mail, and And after you know that that's been sent, you have 3 days to do the same.
Certainly.
I have a different issue. I don't receive the new authority.
Council has raised some authorities that he didn't cite in his brief, that he didn't notify you of, and he didn't file any supplemental authority on. Would you like an opportunity in a similar letter or in the same letter to respond to those?
Yes, if he will set out those.
I'm sure he will.
Couple of cases.
Yeah, I'm sure he will. And then you can respond to them.
And just so I understand what I'm.
So you can make a small argument about whether those cases make any difference or not to what we're discussing.
Thank you.
Thank you. We thank counsel for their briefs and arguments. The matter will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.